Better not handle the merchandise, the other man said. He seemed smarter, but not by much. Remember, you break it, you bought it. Wanting to keep the focus away from her untied wrists, Cheyenne put the hand that was no longer behind her back in her pocket. She barely missed cutting herself on the piece of glass she had hidden there earlier. It was nestled in the kibble that always, since she had gotten Phantom, half-filled her pockets. Cheyenne had learned the hard way to check before she put her clothes in the washer. The kibble was used for rewards, as well as for what the guide dog school had called counter-conditioning. If Phantom was distracted, giving him a piece of kibble was one sure way to get his attention back on her.
Bring me the twine, the second man said. Let somebody who knows what he's doing tie her up.
The gross one sniggered. For a minute, Cheyenne wondered if she could use the glass to hold them all at bay. And then what? She couldn't come up with a scenario that lasted for more than a few seconds. It probably wasn't even possible to cut someone with a broken piece of glass without cutting yourself at the same time.
I've got things under control, Griffin said, and it's not like she's some huge flight risk. She's blind, remember? You guys should go out and finish working on that Toyota.
Nobody moved. There wasn't a sound. She wished she knew what was happening. In the silence, she could feel the tension stretching out between Griffin and the two men. Then the second man laughed.
You just think you got things under control.
But there was a note in his tone, as if he were trying to save face, trying to make Griffin think this was his decision, not Griffin's. Cheyenne and Griffin were both silent until they heard the front door open and close. Then she said,
Thanks. I don't like them.
You're not the only one.
Who are they?
Cheyenne made a conscious effort to look toward his face. People got nervous if you didn't look at them, but for her, the face was no longer important. It was just the place the voice came from.
Guys who work for my dad.
Doing what, exactly? What kind of employees would just accept it if you showed up with a kidnapped girl? Griffin hesitated for so long she wondered if he was even going to answer. Finally, he said,
We sell cars and car parts for cheaper. Say you want to buy a seat for a Honda Civic. If you get it from the dealer, it'll cost you $3,000. Buy it off us, it's a lot cheaper. A lot.
So why is it so much cheaper? Now that the two men were gone, Cheyenne's body was reminding her how sick she was. She had used up all her energy thinking about how to escape, then deciding it would be better to try to find a phone once the house was empty, and then struggling with Griffin.
Do you guys run a wrecking yard or something?
Or something.
Griffin sighed and settled down on the end of the bed. Cheyenne pulled her feet farther back so that she wouldn't touch him.
It's a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
He took a deep breath.
One of the things we do is buy junker cars at auction, stuff that the insurance company has declared a total loss.
And you use them for parts?
Mostly, we just use a couple of the parts. And that's it. Just the ones with the VIN on them.
What's a VIN?
The vehicle identification number. VINs are like social security numbers, only for your car. Each car has a different one. There's a tiny one on every dashboard that you can see through the windshield, but they put them in a few other places, too. The cops can check a VIN to see if a car has been stolen. So once we buy a junker, then we go looking for a second car that's the exact same year, make, and model, only not totaled.
Cheyenne thought she knew where this was going. And you don't buy that other car, do you?
No, we steal it. Then we put the VINs from the junker on the stolen car, and we end up with a car with a clear title and a perfectly legal VIN. We register it with a phony name and address, and then resell it to someone who isn't going to ask too many questions about why they're getting a nice car a couple of thousand under Kelly Blue Book.
But it's stolen!
You really think the person who buys it doesn't have any idea?
Griffin snorted.
They know!
They just don't want to know, if you know what I mean.
So is that why you stole the Escalade? You have a trashed one sitting around someplace that you can use the VINs from?
Cheyenne could hear the reluctance in his reply. That was more like an accident. Normally we get the junker first and then steal the better car. And I don't usually take cars. He stopped himself from saying someone's name, but she filed away the initial.
The other guys do that. I just saw the keys in the ignition and I acted on impulse, obviously. Or I would have noticed that you were in the back. My dad's not real happy with me right now.
So what are you going to do with Danielle's car? Buy a damaged one and switch out the VINs?
But it would always be her family's car, Cheyenne thought. The one with the inch-long scratch on the passenger's side where Phantom's rigid steel harness had caught the first week she had him.
It's a sweet ride, but right now it's a little too hot, even if we put on new VINs and new plates. They'll be stopping every car like it from Seattle to San Francisco. The radio said they've got an Amber Alert out for you. We might just have to part it out, you know, and sell a piece here and a piece there, but not the whole car. A bumper from a car like that might cost $4,000 new from the dealer. We could cut a car repair place a deal for half the price and still come out ahead, since we got the car for free.
For free. Cheyenne guessed that was one way to describe stealing.
But what about the VIN? Won't they know the bumper came from our car?
They don't put the VIN on every part. So once you take a part away from the car, the cops can't trace it. There's a lot of body shops that will look the other way and buy stuff from us. They save money, and we make money, so everybody's happy.
Except the guy who just paid a lot for a stolen bumper. Or the person whose whole car has been turned into a pile of parts.
She could hear his shrug.
My dad says that's what insurance is for.
But what about...
Cheyenne started to argue, only the words caught in her throat. Then she was doubled over, coughing, trying to catch her breath. Griffin brought her some more water, but she waved it away, still coughing. Finally, it was done.
Are you okay?
Maybe she was imagining it, but she thought there was real concern in Griffin's voice.
Not really. Could you maybe just let me sleep?
It was all she could do to hold her head up and have this conversation.
Sure.
She had one last waking thought.
Just keep those guys away from me.
14. Hung for a sheep. Figuring he had better do it before his dad got back, Griffin tied Cheyenne's ankle more tightly to the bed. She barely stirred, her head pillowed on her forearm. She looked exhausted. Except for her flushed cheeks, her face was as white as paper. Griffin got a blue and pink quilt, his grandma had made it when his mother was pregnant with him but didn't know if he was a boy or a girl, from the hall closet and gently draped it over Cheyenne. It smelled kind of musty, but he wanted her to be warm. In a way, it had been a relief to talk to Cheyenne about Roy's business. At first, Griffin had considered not answering her question about what his dad did, or lying. But what was it his grandma used to say before she stopped making sense? Might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb, that was it. Meaning, if you were already screwed, then what the hell? Cheyenne already knew too much, so what was a little bit more? Besides, he had never talked about it to anyone. Griffin had felt a strange sense of pride as he had described the various tricks they used to turn something illegal into something legal, or something that nobody wanted into something that somebody did. He had kept on talking, even when it was clear she was barely staying awake. It had been like trying to stop the air from leaking out of a punctured balloon. He wished he had thought to tell Cheyenne about the strip and run, his favorite trick. TJ or Jimbo would steal a car, strip its parts, and then abandon what was left. Eventually, the police would recover the vehicle and cancel the theft record. Then Roy would purchase the frame at an insurance auction and tow it home. In the barn, the stolen parts would be reattached to the very same car they had come from. The end result was a whole, valuable, and perfectly legal car that Roy could sell for many times more than he had paid for the stripped frame. Thinking about stolen stuff reminded Griffin that there was still a trunkload of loot from the shopping center in the Honda. But there was no way he was going to leave Cheyenne here alone to go sell it on 82nd in Portland, even if she hadn't begged him to watch over her. Griffin didn't think TJ was anything more than talk, but there were times when Jimbo found a way of goading TJ into action. If it worked out, Jimbo would join in. If it didn't, Jimbo stepped back and let TJ take the blame. As he gently closed the door to his bedroom, Griffin wondered when his dad would come back and what he would say when he did. He reached into his pocket for his cigarettes as he walked into the kitchen. Ever since he had brought Cheyenne inside, he had seen the house with new eyes. And what he saw was depressing, shabby, and dirty. It didn't matter that Cheyenne would never actually see it. He slid the cigarette pack back into his shirt pocket, then emptied the sink, filled it with hot, soapy water, and went to work. 2 hours later, the dishes were drying in the rack and the kitchen floor had been mopped until it shone. Griffin had a sudden appreciation for what it must have been like for his mom. No wonder she had left. 2 hours of work, and he knew it could all be undone in a few minutes. Still, he had a feeling of satisfaction. The mail, old newspapers, and random auto parts that had covered the dining room table had been either sorted into neat piles on the sideboard, taken out to the burn barrel, or put away in the barn. Whenever Griffin went outside, TJ and Jimbo didn't seem to be working much, just leaning on half-dismantled cars, their breath clouding the air, talking and gesturing toward the house. They shut up whenever he got near enough to hear what they were saying. Before he turned his attention to the living room, he softly opened the door to check on Cheyenne, as he already had a half dozen times. This time, she was awake and sitting up. "It's 10 to 5, she said. He wondered how she knew that, then saw her click the face of her watch closed. "Please, can we watch the local news? I want to see if it says anything about me." She looked better, but her voice was still hoarse.
"See?" he echoed. "Is it okay to say that around you?"
Something like a smile twisted her mouth. "People get too hung up on that. It's not like if they don't use it, I'm going to forget that I'm blind. My dad even tries not to say he's going to see me later. I keep telling him that see is just a word. Everyone uses it. I use it all the time." She paused and then said in a rush, "I remember what it was like to see. Sometimes I still think I can. When I first wake up in the morning, part of me thinks that when I open my eyes, I'll see my room, you know? Or what's outside my window. And I still imagine what everything looks like." Cheyenne's face, although still pale, was animated. Griffin kind of liked that he could watch her for as long as he wanted and that she wouldn't mind. But whenever her gaze, or what seemed to be her gaze, touched his, he noticed that he still looked away, just as if she could see. Suddenly bold, he asked, "What do I look like then?" "You?" He flushed and was glad she couldn't see him.
"Never mind."
She continued as if he hadn't said anything. "Let's see. You're about 5'11", 170 pounds, strong. I think your hair must be dark. You just sound like you have dark hair. And for some reason, I think you must have a big nose. I mean, it's not a little nubbin, it's not a girly nose." He stared in surprise.
She was right. Right about everything she had said, anyway.
The height and weight shouldn't have been too hard to get, not after he had wrestled with her twice today. Maybe she had even bumped into his nose. He remembered her scratching his face. It was weird, but as she described him, Griffin had expected her to mention the ugly red ribbon of scar that wrapped around his neck. "What about me?" Cheyenne asked. "What do I look like?" He was taken aback.
Don't you know?"
She shrugged. "I haven't seen myself in a mirror for 3 years. I don't have any idea what I look like anymore. The last time I saw myself, I was 13.
Was she flirting with him? Cheyenne's face was open and innocent. Of course, she had worn the same expression when she claimed she had to go to the bathroom. He looked at her dark curls, her olive skin, her heart-shaped face. "You're pretty," he said in a voice that didn't invite any questions. "You're pretty, okay?" He realized he was clenching his fists. For a second, Cheyenne looked surprised, and then she wiped all expression from her face. "The news should be starting on TV now," she said. "Please, can we watch it?" Griffin wondered if this was a trick on her part. Maybe she just wanted to be in another part of the house so that she could find a phone. He let the silence stretch out long enough that she would appreciate how much she was asking of him. "Okay,"
he finally said.
"But I'm going to have to tie you to the couch. And if my dad comes in and starts yelling, you have to promise to be quiet and follow my lead, okay?"
"Promise," she said, and made a gesture like she was crossing her heart. He untied her ankle and then held onto the cord as he took her elbow and walked her into the living room. Once Cheyenne stumbled when she tried to take a step longer than the cord would allow.
"Sorry,"
he said, grabbing her elbow just in time to prevent her from falling over the coffee table. It was actually a giant wooden spool that had once held wire cable. He maneuvered her so that the couch was just behind her knees.
"You can sit down."
Griffin tied her ankle to one of the clawed feet of the old couch, glad she couldn't see the stains on the cushions. As a safety measure, he reached over and unplugged the phone from the wall. Then he sat on the couch, picked up the clicker, and punched in the number for one of the local stations. After a commercial for some kind of adult diaper, Griffin most definitely didn't want to get old, the female announcer appeared on the screen, looking somber. Above her left shoulder, a little box showed a photograph of yellow crime scene tape. "In tonight's top story, the parents of a girl taken today from the Woodlands Experience Shopping Center have made a heart-rending appeal for her safe return. Channel 8's Tammy Engel spoke late this afternoon with Nick and Danielle Wilder, the parents of 16-year-old Cheyenne Wilder." The TV cut away to a man with a tan face and dark hair that was silver at the temples. Beside him was a blonde woman with what Griffin thought of as an expensive haircut, spiky at the edges, with lighter and darker streaks mixed in. They were seated on a dark brown leather couch. Behind them was a rustic stone fireplace, and next to the fireplace towered a huge Christmas tree, decorated all in silver. Griffin figured it was the Wilders' house, but he wondered if it was such a good idea for them to be filmed there. The whole place screamed money. And if Roy saw this, when Roy saw this, he would probably double Cheyenne's asking price. When Mr. Wilder started speaking, Griffin felt Cheyenne jump.
"I will do anything that's necessary to get my precious daughter back," Mr. Wilder said. "People can call me 24 hours a day if they know something."
The camera zoomed in on his face, wet with tears. The tears and the tan didn't go together.
"We need to bring my little girl back home right away. Just imagine how terrifying it is for her. My daughter is blind."
The blonde woman laid a hand on her husband's arm.
"Cheyenne is a strong person. I'm sure she'll get through this."
Then she sighed heavily.
"I feel so guilty. I insisted she not take her guide dog with her. I just thought it would be easier. Now I keep thinking, if only she had had Phantom with her, this would never have happened."
She covered her face. From behind her hands came a strangled noise. "Is she crying?" Cheyenne asked.
"Yeah, so's your dad."
For the second time in a single day, Griffin thought of his own mom, something he seldom allowed himself to do. How would she have reacted? Would she have cried? Or would she have looked out for herself, the way she had 7 years earlier? Cheyenne said in a voice that seemed more for her own ears,
"I've never seen Danielle cry before."
The camera switched back to Mr. Wilder.
Cheyenne is very sick,
he said to the reporter, who nodded sympathetically.
She was diagnosed with pneumonia right before she was kidnapped, and she needs to be on antibiotics. I'm begging these people to let her go immediately. How can they take a girl like that, a helpless child? She must be so frightened.
He turned and spoke directly to the camera.
As a father, I beg you, look at Cheyenne's face. Please, please don't hurt her. Let her go.
His voice turned hard.
And know this. If you harm one hair on my daughter's head, I'll come after you myself.
The reporter, Tammy, leaned forward.
Do you think this is related to your being president of Nike?
Cheyenne's father nodded. The tears were gone from his face now.
It's likely. It's no secret that my daughter means everything to me. They could have been watching, waiting for a time when she was vulnerable. As my wife said, she didn't have her guide dog with her this morning.
Then he addressed Cheyenne directly.
Cheyenne, I know we are physically separated, but my heart...
His words stumbled and broke.
My heart has never separated from you, not for a moment, not for a second. Please be strong. We will get you home soon.
Griffin looked at Cheyenne. She was trembling so hard it was as if she were about to fly apart. Tears were now running down her cheeks, but when she spoke, her tone was angry and agitated.
I thought your dad was going to ask for a ransom. How come they're not saying that they've heard from the kidnappers and are considering their demands? They're talking like they don't know anything.
I don't know.
Griffin raised his voice to match hers.
I have no idea. I've been with you, remember? Maybe my dad wasn't able to get through to them.
The announcer was saying,
Police have released few details about the case, but have suggested Cheyenne Wilder may have been kidnapped for ransom. There is no evidence this was the random act of a sexual predator. Right before we went on air, officials told us they have received over 100 tips so far, and each one is being pursued. The Wilders' phone is constantly ringing, and they are receiving hundreds of emails. The police are concentrating on leads from the public, so if you were at Woodlands today around 10 a.m. and may have seen a green Escalade, license plate 396-CVS, please call a special hotline that has been set up. 1-888-555-1212. Here's a picture of Cheyenne with her dog, Phantom.
The TV cut away to a photo of Cheyenne, grinning. Even the dog, a golden lab, seemed to be grinning. Before he had dropped out of school, Griffin had learned there was a word for that, a word for thinking that animals had the same emotions as humans. Griffin couldn't remember the word anymore. And Griffin knew that he would never see Cheyenne grin like she was in the photo. As he stared at her wide smile, the announcer concluded with,
The race is on to find Cheyenne Wilder and to rescue her alive.
15. Might as well be dead. Cheyenne snapped her head around to face the front door.
What's the matter?
Griffin asked.
Someone's here.
The car she had begun hearing a few seconds earlier pulled up outside the house, fast enough that gravel scattered in its wake. Maybe it was someone coming to rescue her. She remembered the gun that Griffin had. Would he take her hostage? Cheyenne scooted to the far end of the couch, trying to get out of reach.
Crap. Is it my dad?
He clicked off the TV. She heard a car door open and close, then people talking. Just as quickly as they had bubbled up, her hopes burst. Although she couldn't make out the words, Cheyenne recognized the voices. It was Griffin's dad and the two men who worked for him. Quickly, she rubbed her scarf over her face. She didn't want anyone to see her tears. But it was a minute before they came in. She thought she heard another car door close. Finally, steps on the wooden porch. The door crashed open and a cold wind blew over them.
"Fraternizing with the enemy?"
Roy said. He sounded, Cheyenne thought, drunk. The other two men laughed. Cheyenne was as tight as a guitar string.
"Hey!"
Griffin was trying too hard to sound casual.
How'd it go?
Instead of answering Griffin, Roy said,
"This is your cane, right?"
She heard him give it a shake. He must have retrieved it from the Escalade. There was the sound of metal grating on metal, a groan as some kind of door opened. Heat washed through the room. Cheyenne heard fluttering flames, smelled wood smoke. Roy said,
"We don't need to leave anything around that might come in handy for you."
And then she heard him throw the cane inside the stove. The door clanged closed. For so long, Cheyenne had hated her cane. Canes were for old people, handicapped people, not teenagers, not for people like her. But now, as the smell of the smoke changed, she felt lost. Her cane was made of fiberglass, so it might not burn, but the elastic cord that held the sections together certainly would, turning it into a useless bundle of rods.
"What happened? What's the matter?"
Griffin's voice sounded higher pitched, scared.
"Not in front of her. What's she doing out here anyway?"
Roy didn't wait for an answer. She could hear him pacing back and forth.
"Put her back in your room. Then we need to talk."
Griffin hustled Cheyenne away. He tied her ankle to the bed but left her hands free.
"Sorry," he said.
She wasn't sure, but she thought she felt his hand brush the top of her hair. She felt oddly reluctant for him to leave. Who would come through the door next? Griffin might be bad, but she knew the other three men were worse. And why was Roy so angry? What had happened? Had her parents refused to pay a ransom? But that was impossible. Even before she heard him on TV, Cheyenne had known her dad would do anything to get her back. Maybe while she had been napping, Griffin had called Roy with the news about her escape attempt. Was that why he had thrown her cane into the wood stove? Smoke from the elastic cord still hung in the air, and Cheyenne started to cough. Echoing, wet, tearing coughs, like she was going to cough up one of her lungs. When it finally stopped, she was covered with a light sheen of sweat, even though Griffin's room was cold. She found the quilt and pulled it over her. There was nothing else to do. She closed her eyes. Using a cane had been the first skill Cheyenne had had to learn after the accident, and the hardest. Her dad hadn't wanted to let her go to the residential program, but Danielle had persuaded him. That was before Cheyenne's dad and Danielle started dating, before Danielle became her stepmother, back when she was just one of the voices of the nice nurses who cared for Cheyenne. Although in Danielle's case, not so nice. Danielle hadn't believed in spending too much time mourning what was lost. Instead, she wanted Cheyenne to focus on what she had, on what she could do. For the first 2 months after the accident, Cheyenne was basically in bed. First, it was because her broken body needed to heal. After the initial 10 days, when she was out of danger, the hospital recommended that she be sent to a nursing home to recuperate. Her father wouldn't hear of it. His 13-year-old daughter surrounded by old people with strokes and broken hips? Instead, he paid for private duty nurses to be with her 24 hours a day. One of them was Danielle. Once Cheyenne realized that she would never see again, she shut down. What was the point? The world was a scary place. The physical therapist wanted her to go to a special school where she would learn how to be blind. Cheyenne said no to everything, and her dad didn't argue. She didn't like to get out of bed. There was nothing around her. And how could she walk on nothing? If Cheyenne had to go someplace, she slid her feet as if she were on roller skates so that she could still have one foot on the world. All she had left for sure was her body, trembling and sweating. The churning in her stomach, the pounding in her temples, the sounds of her breathing. She no longer knew anything about the world. All she knew about was herself. Her world had shrunk to the edges of her skin. Every time her dad encouraged her to get up, Cheyenne complained that her head ached or that she felt dizzy. Sometimes it was even true. Sometimes she didn't know if it was true or not. Mostly, she stayed in bed and listened to music. Her dad would stand in the door of her room watching her. She could hear him, even if he didn't always say he was there. And Cheyenne would just turn her music up louder. Then one day, Danielle popped the headphones out of her ears. "Hey!" Cheyenne protested. Her hands scrabbled over the bed covers, trying to find them. "Listen," Danielle said, her voice brisk and matter-of-fact. "This is going to be one long, boring life if you don't learn how to function independently. At this rate, you might as well be dead." Cheyenne had held it together so well for weeks, but now she snapped. She was tired of sympathy, but this woman's expectations were way out of line. "Might as well be dead? I am dead. I'll never see anything again. Not a movie, not a person's face, not even my own face." She bogged down thinking of all the things she wouldn't see. Flowers and dogs and the colors of her clothes and sunsets, leaves turning, TV shows and books, concerts, cute boys, cute actors, cute babies. What exactly was making a strange noise? The colors of gelato and the shiny metal tubs they were lined up in, cracks in the sidewalk, people laughing at her. Danielle's voice remained calm. "You're only 13. You've got your whole life ahead of you." "Don't give me any of that crap about how I'm only 13. My life is over. I'm never going to drive a car. I'm never going to go on a date, and I'll be lucky if I get a job in some shelter for the handicapped." Cheyenne made her voice sing-songy, furious that she could still hear the tears underneath. "I'm sick of people saying, 'You're still young, you'll adapt. God never closes a door, but he opens a window.' Well, that's all BS. I won't adapt. I'm blind. My mom's dead, and I'm blind." There was a long pause. Then Danielle said quietly, "You're right. But it is what it is, Cheyenne. You can't change it, so you have to deal with it. You have to figure out how to do things for yourself. You can make a life, and it can be a good one, but you have to try." From outside Cheyenne's closed door, her dad called,
"What are you girls talking about in there?"
"Go away!"
Cheyenne shouted. She didn't want him to see her with tears spilling out of her useless eyes. Then he would start crying, too. She didn't want another pity party. She just wanted to forget. She just wanted to go to sleep and wake up and have it all be a bad dream. She waited until she heard her father's footsteps turn away. Then she said softly,
"But it's too much. It's just too much."
Danielle was relentless.
"Aren't you getting tired of living like a baby? Of having everyone do everything for you? Don't you want to learn how to do some things for yourself?"
It was true. Cheyenne was starting to feel like a baby trapped in a 13-year-old body. Sometimes her dad even fed her. She kept still for a long time, and then, slowly, she nodded. She felt Danielle settle on the bed beside her. Her arms went around Cheyenne. For a second, Cheyenne stiffened, and then she let herself be rocked back and forth while Danielle made shh sounds in her ear. That was how her dad had found them. Later, after Danielle and her dad told Cheyenne they were getting married, she wondered if Danielle hadn't somehow planned being found like that, to show that she could take Cheyenne's mom's place. Still, Danielle hadn't been wrong. And because of her encouragement, Cheyenne had learned how to do a lot of things for herself. More than she had ever thought possible in the first horrible weeks after the accident. Most of what she had learned had been at a residential school 2 hours from her home. Many of the people there were like Cheyenne, in shock, wondering what had happened to them. She remembered in particular one guy who kept saying,
"But how will I be able to do things if I can't drive?"
After a while, she wanted to slug him. He was 40 at least, so he had had a life. He had had his chance. Cheyenne hadn't even really gotten started. Her mom had let her drive once in a cemetery near their house, but now she would never get to for real. And her mom was buried in that same cemetery. Cheyenne had never even been to her grave. At first, when she was at the school, Cheyenne had felt like an alien who had just landed on the planet. She had had to relearn things that she had known how to do for so long that she didn't remember not knowing them. How to feed herself. How to dress herself. How to walk without bumping into things. One of the first things she learned was how to use a cane. Surprisingly light, the cane had a rubber handle like a golf club and a plastic tip. The cane could be folded up into a neat little bundle of sticks. Cheyenne resolved to keep it folded up and hidden away as much as possible. When the instructors told her it glowed in the dark, she imagined how it would give her away at night, the one time she might have a slight advantage over sighted people. Still, while she was at the school, surrounded by other blind people, she decided to learn how to use it. Danielle had told Cheyenne a Bible verse, "For we walk by faith, not by sight." Using a cane was like that. Each step was like stepping into nothing until she felt solid ground under her feet again. It made a taka-taka sound. "Touch, don't tap," the instructors said. They taught her how to sweep it from side to side like a metal detector, touching the spot where the next foot would land. When she stepped forward to the left, she tapped on the right. If there was a hole or something in her way, the cane would find it first. Going downstairs, she held her cane directly in front of her and learned to trust that it would tap when she reached the bottom. Through the feedback she got from the cane, Cheyenne learned to feel grates, ups, downs, carpeting, tile, wood, gravel, curbs, grass, and swishing revolving doors. And she learned that it wasn't just that the cane could tell her what was directly in her path. If she listened closely, she could tell whether the sound it made was bouncing off a brick wall, or echoing in an open doorway, or rebounding off an awning overhead. Even without the cane, she could sometimes tell if there was something ahead of her, like a tree or a telephone pole. As a blind person, Cheyenne had to interpret every shred of information she could get from her other senses. Everyone thought the blind had special abilities, but it was really that they had just learned to pay attention. That they had to pay attention. Now, as she lay on Griffin's bed, Cheyenne remembered the first time the instructors had had her venture out on her own. She had walked down a city street, listening to other people's footsteps around her, fearful she might hit one of them with her cane. That was before she realized that a cane was good for crowd control. Once they saw it, people usually gave her a wide berth. She wondered if they were staring. At one point, she thought she heard someone whispering, but she told herself she was imagining it. After a couple of blocks, her breath finally began to come easier.
"Are you blind?"
someone asked, startling her. The voice belonged to a young boy. Cheyenne turned, not sure she was looking in the right direction. She took a deep breath and let it out.
"Yes." "You must be really bad."
Then she heard the sound of his footsteps running away. At the end of each day, she was there for 3 months, coming home only on weekends, Cheyenne had fallen into bed and slept so hard she didn't even dream. In some ways, she was glad. In other ways, she wished desperately to spend time with her mother again, even if it was only in a dream. The few times she did dream about her mother, Cheyenne was always searching through a huge crowd, only to finally catch just a glimpse as her mom left a room. When the yelling began outside Griffin's door, Cheyenne was so deeply asleep she didn't hear it. 16. You want proof? I'll give you proof. Griffin hurried back into the living room.
What's wrong?
He hadn't seen his dad this angry for a long, long time. Back then, his mom had been around to try to jolly Roy out of it, not that she usually succeeded. For once, TJ and Jimbo were quiet, watching Roy with a look they normally reserved for Duke.
Nothing,
his dad snarled. He had taken the bottle of Maker's Mark out of the kitchen cupboard. He took a swallow of the whiskey and then looked at the two men who worked for him.
How come you're still hanging around? How come you're not at home?
Jimbo knew enough to keep quiet, but not TJ. He said,
Because we wanted to hear what our folks said. How long till we get the money? How much are we going to get? Who said anything about we?
Roy roared.
It's my stupid kid who brought her back to my house. I'm the one who'll take the fall if this thing goes south. When this thing goes south. You guys can turn state's witness and come out of this smelling sweeter than a rose. But
TJ really didn't know when to shut up.
But nothing. Go home now.
Roy took another slug, then wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
We'll talk about it tomorrow. Can we just see her?
TJ asked.
No,
Griffin said firmly.
She needs to rest. Did you tucker her out?
TJ asked with a leer.
Come on, let TJ take a little peek. She's one sweet thing.
Griffin took two steps so that he stood between them and the hallway.
You heard Roy. Go home.
TJ looked at him in surprise. He didn't back away, but he didn't go forward either. Jimbo was the one who finally showed some sense.
Come on, TJ, let's go. It sounds like nothing else is going to happen tonight.
Dad, what's the matter?
Griffin asked after the door closed behind them.
They showed her parents on TV.
He decided to leave out the part about just how nice the house was.
And they said no one had contacted them. Didn't you call them?
Roy looked away.
It took me a while to score a cell phone that I could use. And then when I finally had it, I couldn't find the piece of paper with the numbers on it.
Griffin felt confused.
What are you talking about?
His father leaned forward until their faces were only inches apart and carefully enunciated each word.
I lost it.
Griffin realized how bad Roy's mood really was.
I lost the damn slip of paper, so I couldn't call. I was trying to think of the best way to do this, so I was down at the Green Roof making notes.
The Green Roof Inn was a dive of a bar about 20 miles away, where Roy sometimes went to shoot pool and drink Pabst until he got kicked out for fighting. They always let him back in the next time, though, because if they barred all their customers for that type of behavior, they wouldn't have any left.
So yeah, I watched those rich jerks on the TV above the bar.
All, he pitched his voice higher,
boo-hoo, my baby's gone.
He switched back to his normal voice.
And then, when I went out to the car to call them, I couldn't find the paper. Maybe they're just covering up. I mean, come on. It must be a drag having to watch after this handicapped girl all the time. Maybe they want to get rid of her and start fresh. I think Cheyenne's pretty independent,
Griffin said. He suddenly felt the need to defend her.
She's got a seeing eye dog and everything.
He paused, then said in a rush,
I've been thinking, maybe we should just let her go, without asking for money, and if the cops figured out who we were, which they probably wouldn't, we could explain it was all a mistake.
The blow to his belly came out of nowhere. The next thing Griffin knew, he was on the floor, huddled up. The air was stuck somewhere inside him. His mouth opened like a fish hauled onto the bottom of a boat, but nothing came in and nothing went out. Time seemed to slow down and he could see everything. A paperclip on the carpet, the scuffs on the tips of Roy's work boots, with a kind of sparkling clarity. Was he going to die? And then, finally, the air came rushing back in. It hurt just as bad as when it hadn't been there at all.
"Like that's such a bright idea!"
Roy leaned over him, shouting.
"Like they're going to overlook what it is we do here?"
With every word, spit freckled Griffin's face.
"This chick could be our ticket out. On New Year's Eve, I want to be on a beach someplace warm, drinking Mai Tais. And now, that could happen, but only if we play our cards absolutely right."
Griffin managed to sit up. He turned his head and rested his cheek against his bent knees.
"Sure, you screwed up when you didn't look in the back seat. But now that could be the best thing that ever happened to us. Go get her. I want to get those phone numbers again so I can talk to that fat cat dad of hers."
Griffin had just learned, again, that it wasn't worth talking back to his dad. He got up and went in to get Cheyenne. She was asleep. When he touched her shoulder, she jerked awake, then pushed him away with both hands, her breathing rushed and panicky.
"Easy, easy," he said. "It's just me. My dad wants to talk to you."
"What did my parents say?"
Looking both scared and excited, she sat up.
"How come they acted like they hadn't talked to him yet?"
"Because they haven't. He needs you to give him the phone numbers again. He lost the paper that had them, but don't say nothing to him about it. He's in a real bad mood." Cheyenne wiped her face clean of all expression and nodded. Griffin untied her ankle and walked her down the hall. Holding a cell phone so big it was almost funny, Roy was waiting for them.
"All right, what's your home number again?"
Cheyenne recited it in a dead voice. Griffin watched his dad's expression as he listened to the phone ring. His face changed when someone answered.
"Listen," Roy barked. "I've got the girl. I've got Cheyenne Wilder. I'm offering you a trade. You give me money and I'll give her back. It's that simple."
His eyes narrowed.
"Do you want proof? I'll give you proof."
Forgetting she was blind, he thrust the phone at Cheyenne. When she didn't take it, he swore and fumbled it into her hand.
"Don't say anything stupid," he warned her.
"Daddy?"
Her face changed. Suddenly, she looked like a little kid.
"Daddy?"
She bit her lip at the answer.
"Oh, I'm okay, but..."
"That's enough."
Roy yanked the phone away from her and put it back to his ear.
"I'm sure you got that taped. You run that through your computers or have her parents listen to it, and they'll tell you that I'm telling the truth. And you tell them we're going to need $5 million. Nothing larger than a 50. Unmarked, non-consecutive bills, or you're going to get her back in pieces."
Griffin's mouth fell open. $5 million?
Jeez, why hadn't his dad just asked for 500 zillion quadrillion? $5 million was impossible. Even if it was all in 50s, that would still be...
He thought about it for a second.
100,000 bills. They would need a forklift for that.
"We'll be in touch,"
Roy said, almost jauntily. He clicked off the phone and gave Griffin a grin. His anger seemed to have evaporated. After 17 years of living with him, Griffin knew that looks could be deceiving.
"That wasn't even my dad you had me talk to," Cheyenne told Roy. "Do you know that? That wasn't even my dad."
Tears shone on her cheeks, but her voice didn't tremble at all. Roy shrugged.
"It was probably a cop. I heard a clicking on the line. They're probably trying to trace the phone. That's why I hung up, just to be on the safe side. Next time I call, I'll tell them to put the money into a bag and drop it off someplace we can watch to make sure that nobody's followed it. After we get the money, we'll check it out to make sure there's not a tracking device or dye on the bills. And then we'll let you go."
Cheyenne nodded. She looked like she didn't believe Roy. Griffin didn't think he did either. For the first time, he had an unsettling thought. Roy would eventually let Cheyenne go, wouldn't he? 17. Working in the dark. Cheyenne swam out of a dream where she had been lost and running into things.
Are you hungry?
Griffin asked from the doorway. It took her a minute to orient herself. She was in a room in an old house in the middle of nowhere. Only four people knew where she was, and they were the ones who were holding her captive.
Are you hungry?
Griffin asked again. She wasn't hungry. She wasn't anything. She was empty. After her escape attempt had failed, Cheyenne had pinned her hopes on the idea that Griffin's dad was setting up a trade. She had told herself that she might even be home tonight. She had tried not to think about the details too much, intentionally kept them fuzzy. The only concession she had made to reality was to admit that maybe it might not happen until after midnight. When Cheyenne still didn't answer, Griffin continued on as if she had.